Are you passionate about making a difference through design? Join us at the Human Centered Design Network's Circle, a new private community for changemakers just like you. Connect with like-minded professionals, gain exclusive rights to monthly learning opportunities, and lead the change in human-centered design. For more information, see thisishcd.com. Now, let's get back into that episode. Welcome to Doing Design Podcast on This Is HCD, hosted by all the world's best live design and innovation trainers from thisisdoing.com. The Doing Design Podcast focuses on all the behind-the-scenes things related to actually doing innovation and design, such as design research, facilitation, prototyping, visualization, and it's a great sounding board for industries like service design, user experience, content design, product management, and probably a few other ones there as well. In this episode, you'll hear from myself and Craig van Dijk, one of the best design researchers that I know of. And we speak about structuring design research projects for success. It's a good one. Let's jump straight in. Craig, how are things? Great to speak with you.
Yeah, likewise. I'm good. You're good.
You're back in London town.
Yes, after 7 months in Amsterdam.
Yeah. 7 months in Amsterdam. And you did the quarantine as well.
Passed that. Yeah, 2 weeks isolation and now free to roam.
Yeah, very good. So God knows the next time when I'll be back in London, but I'm sure it's good to be back there. It's a great city. Craig, today we're going to be chatting more around design research, because I know on This Is Doing, you've got a number of great courses that you're running. One of them is Deep Dive into Design Research. But today we were chatting beforehand and we think it could be an interesting topic to talk about structuring a design research project for success. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Typically, what are the problems that you're seeing from people or practitioners and how they're structuring their projects not for success?
Yeah, that's a good topic. I'd like to speak about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But typically, what are you seeing, like, you know, in the industry? What are the common pitfalls that you're seeing practitioners do?
Well, one, the big one is that people tend to focus a lot on fieldwork. Everybody gets excited about doing interviews or shadowing people or making films. But often the next steps are not really thought through. So then you end up with a big pile of material. If it's not been thought through, half of it is not used because people are overwhelmed with data, don't have a process to bring things together. That's a big pitfall.
Yeah. It's interesting. I've been part of many projects over the years, and some of them have had really, really big extended periods of design research and capturing huge data sets. And they don't know what to do with the data at the very end of it. They just kind of surmise generally. Why do you think it is that practitioners get so excited about going out and doing research?
It's the same thing with creating. People love the diverging. People love brainstorming. People love doing interesting things and less anticipate that the next step is to converge. And that is also very satisfying, I find. Mm. But it's also frustrating if you haven't prepared for it well. And that sort of keeps that going. If you don't prepare it, the experience is less optimal. And then you're not going to like it. So next time you're not going to prepare for it. Whereas if you have prepared, it can be a moment of flow as well, where things, like all these jigsaw puzzle pieces, they fit together and you see the picture. So it can be very satisfying, but then you need to prepare. It's not an afterthought.
Yeah. Do you think it's an estimation problem? Do you think people are miss or underestimating the time it takes to sense make? Like if they spend 3 days out in the field, you know, typically I double that in terms of the back end of sense making. So 3 days, and then I do 6 days sense making, which is quite a lot.
Yeah. Even it's a little bit the other way around, I think. If you don't prepare, you're going to end up spending a lot of time trying to get through the mess. If you do prepare, you can do it very efficiently. Because then if you prepare your fieldwork materials, like your script and the sheets you're using, if you thought them through to not just the use in the field, but also for your documentation purposes and also for bringing it together in the analysis, you can do it very efficiently. So actually you win time there. I see the sun is coming through, so let me, sorry.
Yeah, the sun is shining in Dublin as well today, so it's kind of like, it's a welcome break in the clouds for us over here. Ireland, it's been raining for the last couple of days. Typically, whenever I've done design research projects, specifically design research projects, not just as part of bigger things, I always kind of have an understanding of the artifacts and the things that I'm going to be trying to capture in those things. So like scripts and, you know, how they're going to be translated and what I'm going to do with them afterwards. Are you saying that like there's lots of practitioners out there that just generally go out with a notepad and a dictaphone and a script and just...
No, I think they will make like templates for journey maps, for instance. And they have all these sheets and do lots of mapping, because that's a big practice, of course, in our field. But if you don't think it through to then how do I process it in terms of documentation and basically digitize it, and then from all the individual interactions I had with people, how do I do that in a structured way so that I can aggregate it and see the patterns? Mm. Because that's what you're doing in your analysis, right? If you do your fieldwork in a structured way, you do your documentation in a structured way, then your cross-comparison should be a breeze. If you don't, if you're just doing fantastic, exciting things everywhere and you're documenting it in different ways, it's really difficult to bring it together.
It's free-flowing. So walk me through what a typical Rijk van Dijk structure might be then.
Well, one thing is to not only think about the moment you're doing your interactions with your participants, but to really think, then what? I'm coming out of that interview, or I'm coming out of that day of observations, or coming out of that co-creation workshop, and prepare, let's say, your templates in a way that you can add your notes to it. Because you will have loads of annotations and thoughts, because it's qualitative research, right? So some things are being said by the participant, but also some things aren't being said, and you observe it, or you have an interpretation of what happened, and you want to take those notes. So you need to leave space in your templates to do that. And that's the stage of what we typically call documentation. That's not even analysis. It's just following on from the fieldwork, individual fieldwork, and then to think through, okay, if I have all these journey maps, for instance, how will I almost stack them up and look across and to see where are recurring themes, issues that people encounter, or unfulfilled dreams, or big frustrations that people have. And then you see patterns. Mm. You see that, oh my God, everybody is hitting this wall. Or, whoa, some people are hitting this wall and others aren't. Why? Are these people different? Is there some sort of segmentation I need to do?
Yeah. So you zoom a bit further out then?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you can do that if you can look through all the details. So there's a good structure in how you've done your documentation. You can label things.
On This Is Hate City, we've got a fantastic research person, Jay Asbrook, who wrote a great book called Ethnographic Thinking. Mm-hmm. And Jay has a wonderful chapter in it about when he went to Japan and he was exploring for a US-based company insights, and I can't remember the story's specifics, but he encountered very little in the traditional sense of design research when he was going into stores looking for patterns and in sort of sales within the store environment. But it wasn't until he was walking down the street that he saw this unusual sign. It was a black shoe just hanging there. There was no light on it or any of this kind of stuff. And he saw this really funky person going into the store or the building even. And he followed them in and he sat down and he just observed. And he noticed that there was this very well-presented lady came out and said to the person like and presented a pair of shoes to him. And he said, he couldn't understand what was going on here. And the person opened up the box and was like nodding ahead in approval. And they took the shoes and they left with a little pamphlet as well. So he went up to the lady and says, well, what is this building? And he says, oh, this is a shoe hotel. And it's a place for people to put their shoes in because a lot of people in Tokyo don't have a lot of closet space. So we look after the shoes and they wear them and they bring them back and then we repair them and we polish them and clean them. And then we also suggest all these other kind of styles and fashions that might be mm-hmm. might be applicable. You're an influencer as well. And Jay has, it's a really good story that I've used many times to reflect on being able to go off-piste within design research and allowing for things just to flow and allowing for things to happen. Well, what are your thoughts in terms of, and is this just something that you may or may not have seen, that design researchers tend to be quite rigid in terms of their approach and unwilling to mm-hmm. to go off-piste? Is this a thing that you've seen?
Well, I'm biased, of course, because I mostly see my team and the partners I work with who don't display that behavior, so I don't know. Mm. But I would say that that comes back to that fine balance we talked about before between structure and openness, because yes, you need to look, yes, you're briefed on a topic, but you need to be open enough, looking at it holistically, to find opportunities that might be lingering at the periphery. But at the same time, you should not be naive, of course, and be like, oh, I'm not going to have a focus. I'll just be open for everything, because then you'll be so superficially looking at everything, you'll never find it. So you need some rigor to investigate things, to deep dive. So probably your story from Jay's experience is, because he's a very experienced researcher, he's able to sort of drift on the periphery and then find these nuggets.
Yeah.
And it's not because he's completely inexperienced and just following his nose. And that's really something that comes back in all the stages of design research, that you need that fine balance between structure and openness. So you need to prepare in order to be able to improvise. And that's also with your interaction with your participants. You prepare well, that means you have a foundation, but the moment you meet them, you can sort of be open and almost be like, everything is possible, just talk to me, but you know that you know what your focus is, you know where the magnets are, and that's the same in the analysis. You know what you're looking for, but because if it's an innovation project, you are not looking to refine things that are already there, you're looking for opportunities. So you need to be open to find unknown unknowns, but they're not coming out of sheer naivety. Way of working.
Yeah.
You have a rigorous process to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So identifying, like, say the script creation is one that whenever I've you know, helped teams, it's this whole kind of identifying what should we focus on. Yeah. They know they're going to do research. They've typically working in projects. So we've got a block of time set aside to do some research. What approaches and what things do you think people could do better on selecting the themes that they research on?
Yeah, maybe it's a bit boring response, but it's that same balance between structure and openness. So there's questions in your script of things you need to know, and there's questions in your script that might be nice to know. So you always build your script for focus, the things, it's almost like the known unknowns. So in your briefing and your conversation with the client, there's things where they say, we know that we don't know, so please go and investigate this. But you know that if you also explore a little bit around it, you'll find things that are in the bucket of unknown unknowns. And in the end for the project, those might be even more valuable, but you don't know. So you need to cast your net wide enough to catch those. But you shouldn't be all about unknown unknowns, because you still need to deliver to what at the start of the project was the hypothesis that you're trying to investigate. But that hypothesis is limited on what you know that you don't know. So we built a script to be fishing in both of those pools. And then it means in your script you have, let's say, blocks that are dedicated to certain topics, and you always try to put in some questions. We need to know this, and maybe this will be nice to know as well. That's casting that net a little bit wider.
One of the most common things after the script has been created, they said, okay, well, getting a screener together and getting either a recruiter or trying to find participants to partake in the study. And then the next question, it almost rigorously and religiously appears in front of my eyes. How many people do we need? And how many people is enough? And typically I always go 25% over the number, because you'll get a fall away. Potentially, you get a couple people dropping out in the sessions. Typically, how many people would you consider to be a fair amount for an accurate response or an accurate story.
Well, you can talk about this for days, but actually,
I know, it's a big question.
So any experienced qualitative researchers can tell you that that is, let's say, an educated guess for every project, because it's also about how clear is the group you're investigating. Sometimes you're not really sure, so you need to cast that net a bit wider and you say, let's go for a bigger group. Sometimes it's pretty clear what kind of people you need to investigate, and then you go for a lower number. So, yeah, I don't know.
It's how long is a piece of string?
Yeah, exactly. yeah. What we do know is that there's no point in going on and on and on. So sometimes clients ask for a larger sample size than we think would be necessary. And we really tell them, you're wasting your time, you're wasting your money, because there's a certain saturation point you arrive at doing this research. So as a researcher, you start with a group that together with reasonable doubt, you establish, let's just talk with these 10, 15, 20 people and we'll see. And then once you've the eighth or the ninth, you think, I'm hearing the same things. I can go on, but my saturation point is there. Sometimes you find that, maybe not. Maybe we're missing something here. And that doesn't happen often, but if that's necessary, you need to be honest and say to yourself and your colleagues and your clients that we need to go on, because there's the saturation point, the patterns aren't consolidating.
Yeah, they're not repeating.
Yeah. So I would say just start with a sample you can bite off and chew and don't overdo it. And then ask yourself the question, do we feel that we found enough resonance for our findings that we can safely say if we do another 10 interviews, we will probably find most of these insights.
Yeah, the same themes again.
Yeah.
So it's going until you hit that point, really. That's what
It's not about the number. It's about that confidence of, have we found what we were looking for?
Yeah, to quote Bono.
And it's also, you're looking for opportunities. So even if we've been doing a research with maybe 10 or 15 participants, in the end, the findings that really spark the next concept development usually don't come from everyone. So you're fishing, and there might be maybe two or three participants who really strongly display a certain need or a behavior that we think, oh, that's something we could build on. And then we see it in a weaker resonance with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that can already be the spark for a fantastic innovation project. And then you can do all your validation later. At least that's the area where we work in as design researchers.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't know if I gave you that example before, but the fishing and hunting.
No, example, I don't think so. I've heard of one like this, but I don't want to hear. I want to hear your version.
We sometimes have that conversation in the early stage of projects with client teams, that when they start briefing us and they're like, oh, for the screener, we need two of these people and one of those people and two of these people and three of those people. That's a hunting exercise. You think you already know, and you want to know exactly from this person, I'm going to ask you that and get you that question. But we find that the type of work we do is more like a fishing exercise. There is, we know there's fish in the sea, and we know there's very interesting opportunities we can get out and we can build on for the concept development, but we don't know exactly how many or how many different types or how big they are, but we know there's some fish there. So the exercise is to be there at the right time, to have the right equipment, all the conditions need to be there. You fish, you're patient, and you'll find something. Hunting is different. You know that you want, I shouldn't make that exercise vegetarian.
I've never hunted in my life. But rake, sounds like you have.
And then you're just going to sit there and wait until you see the rabbit that you know is there, or the deer or whatever. That's a different type of research.
No animals were hurt in this design research project.
Yes. Bad example. But the mental model is different.
Yeah.
And that is the... Absolutely. That, again, illustrates that balance between structure and openness. You need to prepare And you need to have the experience to know how to set the right conditions, and then you'll catch something. But it's a different mental model than the hunting mental model.
Mm-hmm. So what typically, standby in my world, leading the way in many of the areas of design research, what kind of tools do standby use to aid their sense making?
Oh, there are several. It's a lot of sort of mapping. I think if people are interested, what's always a fantastic resource is a toolkit we made, and it's freely available for everyone with Nesta and Rockefeller, DIY toolkit, DIYtoolkit.org. And there's quite some tools in there. So there's a causes diagram, which is also always fantastic to use. It's just setting yourself the task to think, what are the symptoms we have observed? But actually, you're looking for the causes. And that's a question you have to ask yourself as a researcher during your analysis. So I'm observing something, but is that really why it's happening? You're always looking to the why, right? And of course, the famous five whys exercise.
Yeah.
It's a painful one, but it's very true. And that is why we always say in standby, you never do these analysis sessions alone. You always have your at least one buddy or a couple who are in the same project and who have all been involved in the fieldwork. So they've soaked up the data and the observations and the anecdotes that people gave them. But when you're interpreting it in your sense making, you're trying to dive underneath. So you're not looking at what are people doing. That is your symptom. Mm-hmm. But you're looking at why. So what drives them in a positive way, as in aspirations, or what drives them in a negative way, as in frustrations or barriers that are there. And I must say the causes diagram really helps with that. So you would do it anyway as a researcher, but that helps you to make it explicit.
Conscious diagram is what you said.
A causes diagram. Yeah.
Well, that again, just so.
Causes, as in CAUSES, causes, the cause.
Or courses.
Cause, as in.
Or causes.
I'm sorry.
I was like, the conscious
the cause,
diagram.
What's the cause? Yeah,
causes diagram. Yeah. Okay, causes fair. Diagram. I was like, I've never heard of the conscious diagram. I'm like Googling it here at the same time. Nothing's coming up. And I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's funny, like, that.
Yeah, so literally use the tool, but it's
good to be aware of it.
It's an activity you need to do in any analysis. Why is this happening?
Yeah.
So that's a good one. And definitely, I think many people in our field are using something like a journey map in the field work. Mm. But we always say the journey map is, let's say, the as-is situation. So you're looking at what's happening now. And what you're basically doing is mapping the symptoms. What are the behaviors and why are people saying they're doing it? But in your analysis stage, you're taking those same journey maps and you're not looking at individual ones, but you're stacking them up and looking almost like transparent layers through, and you're looking at what are recurring patterns or recurring highs and lows, and then you do that same exercise. What's causing this?
Yeah.
Because then you find either the pain points where you say, well, that's a good starting point for ideation, but you can also find an aspiration, something that's not met, an unmet need, and you're thinking, whoa, they have a workaround for something. Why doesn't this client organization provide a service for this?
Why doesn't it exist?
So that leads to opportunities where you say, oh, there's an opportunity here. And that leads you to the next tool, which is, again, the journey map, but it's a journey map to be. How could it be different? So that's where you're almost sliding from sense-making into ideation.
Yeah.
So again, that is thinking it through. We're using this tool of a journey map in an early stage in order to do a structured documentation, in order to do our sense making, in order to kickstart the ideation.
Yeah, the journey map to be is a wonderful fluid way into ideation. I find it's very accessible as well for stakeholders who may not appreciate a large wall of post-its and the amount of work that goes into kind of sense making that. But a journey map to be is like, they feel like, oh, it's an opportunity for them to have their voice.
Yeah, that's often where the penny drops. Yeah, where things really come together. Yeah. And then we're often migrating
on the data.
Yeah. And then again, in a later stage in the project, we often migrate to journey map to B into a service blueprint, because then suddenly you have these layers underneath. What does your organization need to do to improve this journey to be for a customer? Front office, back office, what kind of instruments do you need for that? So that's a really
Yeah. Or you could do the quadrant models of stuff where the opportunities lie. And like I know Mark, we actually had a class yesterday and he had a wonderful piece in there where he was saying some of those pieces in the quadrant model of, you know, opportunities, there's dependencies on them. And, you know, you might have stuff that's really hard to implement, but if you tackle that one first, all the other pieces that are dependent on them might become more available and easier to execute on.
Yeah.
So there's lots of things.
Because from your sense making, you're often identifying several opportunities, but they're not equal. Some are easy to do, some are difficult, some are, let's say, very urgent, and some are, let's say, need to do's or nice to do's. So you need to filter those out. Yeah.
Because it's very easy for people to say, oh, well, the low hanging fruit, we'll just tackle the low hanging fruit.
Mm.
But really, you may be tackling low hanging fruit for the rest of your life if that's the approach. Sometimes you have to take.
Exactly.
The big bite and, you know, do the hard work and take the big chunks first, and then the rest of the low-hanging fruit just kind of dissipates. Yeah. And
you should do all of it. It's not either or.
Yeah.
And that's interesting with my collaboration with Wietse van der A for the innovation management. He often points it out that we shouldn't discard it as well. Low-hanging fruit can be super important for a business. So it's also not, oh, let's do the radical thing. Incremental is super important as well and can be very innovative. So it's not either or, but it's, you need to do all those. So in the quadrants, one is not interesting, of course, the one where it's simple and not urgent. But all the other ones are very important. You need to do all of them. So for strategic innovation management, that mapping is very important, and you need to follow up on all of them. But the follow-up is different.
Yeah. Now, Raik, I know you've got a deep dive into design research. What we've spoken today has been probably very interesting. But tell us about what's going to be in that course, in a deep dive into design research, and what might and who might find value in that course.
Yeah. Well, what we ideally would like to offer to people is you, in one way, you're familiar with the basics of design research, but you know, entering, even if you have a little bit experience of a lot of experience, you know that every project you'll start doing design research, there's questions of customizing. And the real craft is in customizing, making your decisions on fieldwork tools, sense-making tools. And that's the conversation we want to address. So it is about that fine balance between structure and openness. How do you find that in the different stages of the project?
Yeah.
And how do you make those fine-grained trade-offs in choosing your tools and setting up your process?
I'm definitely going to be sitting in that session, actually. There's, you know,
there's
lots. No, there's so many things, and I think that's what's I always gravitated towards design research, because no one in the design research field feels like they've got it down pat. There's no one who's kind of like, yeah, I've got it. This is
be
done.
First to say yes, yeah, I don't have that.
There's this huge sense of humility in the research world where they're like, we just don't know, and we're always learning. So this course is a really good opportunity to unpack some of those things and have those great conversations and increase the learning zone.
But also to be confident that we do know a lot. We do know a lot about structuring, and we do know a lot about the rigor, but that doesn't mean we're rigid, that it always needs to be done in that way. If your foundation is strong enough, then you're in an excellent position to be flexible and to customize it and to be agile in the process. But only being in that agile, flexible bit makes a very shaky foundation. So it's really about that balance between, but you need both.
Yeah.
And I'm giving the course together with Babita George from Quicksand. And also she's done so many projects. There's so many examples of making that fine-grained consideration between structure and flexibility.
Craig, we're coming towards the end of the episode. It's as always, every time I speak to you, I walk away with a smile on my face, and I've always learned something new. But if people want to follow you on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
I think Hello Geke. That's the handle I use everywhere. Twitter, LinkedIn. Our LinkedIn is Geke van Dijk. Yeah.
It's funny, at this is doing, I got to know everyone's handles, so I know it's Hello Rake and Bass's is Hello Bass. It's good. Rake, have a great time over in London, and we'll chat with you soon.
Nice conversation. Thank you very much.
So there you have it. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisis8cd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. Now, if you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is 8CD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network, and also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisis8cd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.